Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
The Dan Bernstein Show. Weekdays 9 a.m. to noon on Sports Radio 670 The Score.
It's just sad that we got to hear about things happening, you know, in our workplace and stuff like that via Twitter. I mean, it's good, it's entertaining, it's fun, but just want more communication. Like, let us know. Don't just string us along, man. If the NBA is starting, if the NBA is finished, just let us know. I challenge the NBA. We work blood, sweat, and tears for this league, and you know we feel like it should be a certain line of respect that you know we should be knowing what's going on.
And members of Blood, Sweat, and Tears, Patrick Beverley on ESPN talking about the current situation, and that's a league where there is general trust between the sides. You compare that to baseball or even perhaps hockey and football right now. The NBA, at least in general, there's less enmity than you may have in other leagues. But it looks like they're going to play something, somehow, somewhere, probably down at Walt Disney World. And here to talk about the NBA is a guy you hear often on these airways, Brian Geltzeiler of Sirius XM. And he is at Hoops Critic. He joins us now on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline, Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park. Geltzy, how you hanging?
I'm good, Dan. How we doing, buddy?
Okay, well enough, and trying to emerge from whatever this is as slowly and safely as possible. But it does appear the NBA is swirling into something here. And I've heard all sorts of proposals of what the resumption of the season in some way is going to look like and how they're going to maybe allow some of these Western teams to get their fair shot at the playoffs. But the more I've thought about it, I think the smartest thing, and I don't know about you, but if you had to pick one, shouldn't they just start the playoffs right now and seed these 16 teams and have their regular playoff series as best they can?
I believe in my heart of hearts that that is the best option right now on a variety of levels. In terms of obviously protecting people health-wise, you're going to bring 16 teams there instead of more than that, which is less people in that bubble, less people exposed from that standpoint. I think that matters. I think when you look at the integrity of a playoff, and I know that the league has experimented with a lot of different things over the course of the last couple of years in terms of trying, you know, a play-in tournament and trying a World Cup type of group bracket to work that way and have some more games be played and then have that graduate into a playoff. I see all the logic there, but here's my thing. Either if you're not, you know, you had a set of rules when the season started. If you're not either going to start a playoff with 16 teams, and let's face it, Dan, they have played less than an 82-game regular season in the past for reasons that are a lot worse than this one, you know, in terms of because they had a lockout in 99 and a lockout in 11 with shortened seasons when both sides are fighting over money. So this is a much better reason to have a shortened season. So if you had to just jump off at the playoffs from here, that's fine. But if you're not going to do it that way, I actually think the only other fair way is to do something that involves all 30 teams. Because otherwise, whatever line you're going to draw is going to be arbitrary in one form or another. Now, I would tell you the two ways that I would like it the most, either 16 or 30, are the two least likely right now. Something's going to happen that falls in the middle. And listen, a lot of this, you know, you had a bunch of teams competing for that last spot in the West. And I do think that when you talk about incorporating your TV partners into some of what they want and this conversation, a big part of this has to do with the fact that they'd like the New Orleans Pelicans involved. And Zion Williamson on TV screens could be a just helpful for ratings in a year where, let's face it, the TV partners have taken it on the chin in a big way before COVID-19 ever came about. The TV partners were getting beat up here, Dan. So now if they can get a couple of Zion games and do a couple of big ratings in some games before you're getting your Giannis and your LeBron and your Kawhi Leonard and your James Harden, et cetera, I think that will be something that the TV partners would like a lot.
One thing that we're noticing across sports is this may be an opportunity, however these leagues reconstruct their seasons, to force down some changes that would be acceptable in a fashion that they otherwise wouldn't be. For example, the universal DH would be likely if baseball comes back. What about with a receding possibility for the playoffs, for which we've clamored in the past to say, don't have a de facto final in the semifinals if you can avoid it, with fans wanting to see the two best teams playing for a championship. Could that happen?
I think it could. I think that's a lot more possible than a 1-16 seeding. I think the problem with the 1-16 seeding is that for this year, everybody will say, well, okay, but it's going to be a one and done, because ultimately the coastal teams are never going to agree to it. They're never going to agree to have to do that kind of travel, you know, in the first round of the playoffs if they get paired. You know, if you end up with whether it's the Lakers, Brooklyn, I'm just throwing out, you know, coastal options, you know, or Portland and the Miami Heat. These teams don't want that kind of travel during the playoffs. If you get to the finals and that's what you have, well, that's the finals. That's a little bit different. But doing it on the front end of the playoffs, they don't want it. So I don't think you're going to get that 1-16. And if you do, it's going to be a one-and-done deal, because there's going to be a huge clamor from the coastal teams, and the coastal teams carry a lot of power here. So I don't think from that standpoint we'll see that. In terms of reseeding the Final Four, I think that actually makes a lot of sense. And I think this could be the year that we see them experiment with that. Because here's the other thing. The biggest rating they could do, as much as in terms of looking at the top teams, as much as you'd love to see the Milwaukee Bucks get into an NBA final and play against the Lakers or the Clippers, if they could have LeBron and Anthony Davis on one side and Kawhi Leonard and Paul George on another and have that be the NBA final, that would be a heck of an NBA final for the league, for the TV partners. And I think they believe they could kind of get that lined up if they end up doing something with a reseeding in the Final Four. They would look to have that matchup and be able to push that matchup to a final. I think that would be a huge deal for the league. And I think it's a significant possibility that we see that happen this year.
And you know what they could do if it's that one in particular? You don't have to do that in Disney World. By that time, you can pack up the Disney operation and just strip down your finals and go right to the Staples Center.
You could, but I doubt they would do that just because of the level of planning involved, man. You know what I mean? Like, you plan so much to have all, you know, there's a lot of logistics that go into place here. And those logistics are a lot of what's being debated right now with why there really isn't a plan yet. I mean, you had Adrian Wojnarowski and Ramona Shelburne had a story yesterday about the Players Association really pushing for families to be involved in this bubble. And I think that's problematic on a bunch of different levels. But, like, you played that soundbite from Patrick Beverley about wanting to be in the mix about what's going on. Listen, the players are in the mix. Michelle Roberts is being kept afloat, and what the players want here is certainly being strongly considered. Adam Silver is in an unenviable position right now, Dan. He's got a lot of different masters to please. And in the end, not everyone is going to be happy with what he does. There's no way he can rule by consensus here. Whatever he does, there's going to be people that have complaints. But ultimately, I think what he's trying to do is make sure that he has players that feel as comfortable as possible, with the understanding that, hey, if you don't want to come play, don't come play, but understand your money's tied to your willingness to show up. And so that the league has that power to void guys' money if they decide not to show up. And really, when you talk about playing, you know, a playoff this year and crowning a champion, it's the current financial model that's at stake. It's going to be changed and altered in some way because of the fact that, you know, 40% of the revenue comes from people being in the buildings, and you're not having that. So there will be some kind of small short-term alteration. But showing up and playing right now is really what these players need, so there's not a long-term alteration to the financial model costing these guys a whole lot of money. And make no mistake about it, as much as you hear guys complaining, the guys that are complaining are taking that money for granted. You got to show up and generate the revenue, guys. That's why you get paid the big bucks. It's not an entitlement. And I think that's something that Michelle Roberts and the Players Association has done a fantastic job getting across to her constituency. And the superstars involved in this, who are very involved in the Players Association, have all kind of gotten their arms around it for the most part.
Looks like the Bulls season is over, and judging from the poll that was done by Joe Cowley of the Chicago Sun-Times, every Bulls fan is ecstatic about that. Nearly 70% of Bulls fans wanted them to not be a part of some sort of resurrected season or postseason, and that means that they can get on with what is expected to be the coaching change of your guy, Jim Boylan. As we know, it took some time for you to come around to the idea of the necessity of having to move on to their own guy for Arturis Karnišević and Mark Eversley. Now, the names we've heard have been Adrian Griffin, Ime Udoka, you floated Kenny Atkinson, but one thing that we learned about them as they took those jobs, they keep talking about empowering the players and how it is about the players. This is going to be a players' side coaching hire. This isn't going to be an old-school autocrat. This is going to be somebody who is a much more either former player or considered a players-type coach. Any other names we should consider beyond the two apparent favorites right now, Griffin and Udoka?
I still would put Atkinson in that mix. I know that he landed as the number two guy on a Nick list yesterday that Shams Charania and Mike Workunoff had on The Athletic. But I don't know if Kenny has other options, if that's a job he would necessarily want to take. And I do believe that the Knicks' job is Thibodeau's to lose. I think for the Bulls here, I think Griffin is probably the leader in the clubhouse right now. But I've been saying it to you for a while, Dan. I would keep an eye on Kenny Atkinson with all this. Because even though he doesn't have the former player thing, he is considered a player-friendly guy. And just because Durant and Kyrie Irving didn't want him doesn't mean that he wouldn't be the right coach for the Bulls. The one other guy I would take a look at is Dave Vanderpool from Portland, who has been up for a lot of jobs over the years, very, very well liked by players. I think he's a guy that absolutely gets considered here. The Bulls' job can be a very attractive job here because of the level of talent that they have and because of the reputation of Arturis Karnišević. There's no doubt about it. So I think from that standpoint, they can kind of cast a little bit of a wide net. But the one name I keep hearing over and over again there is the name you mentioned, Adrian Griffin. I think Adrian Griffin's a guy that has been overdue for this kind of opportunity. And I think there's a comfort level with this new management team with Griffin. And I think they think he would go over real well with the players.
Let's talk about Thibodeau for a second. If, in fact, you think, as you say, the Knicks' job is his to lose, the tactical chops are absolutely unquestioned. The work ethic is absolutely unquestioned. And I've said today that if I have one game plan to have handed in for my life here, and I have one guy who's in that dark room watching film telling me who I've got to stop, what my pick and roll defensive rules are, that's the guy. That's one of the best defensive game planners who's ever been around the NBA. The issues with him were real when it came to how he interacted with people and his rough edges and his inability to see some nuance in things. Has he changed sufficiently that his negatives can be fully outweighed by his many positives?
Listen, I don't think he had to change a ton, Dan. And I think he has changed a little bit. The short answer is yes. I think he has changed a little bit in the fact, listen, Tom is, from a personal standpoint, and I love Tom personally, and I make no bones about it, from a personal standpoint, Tom is as warm, sweet, and engaging a guy as you'll ever come across and meet. He really is. He's terrific. He has his particular opinions about basketball, and they're unwavering. And I think when you look at what's happened with Tom's reputation, the one thing that people tend to ignore when it comes to Tom Thibodeau is how good his teams actually do, how much he gets out of them. Listen, look what happened to the Bulls when he left. Darnell Mayberry of Athletic wrote a piece about a month ago about how the Bulls have not recovered from picking essentially Paxton and Foreman over Tom Thibodeau. They have not recovered from it. Tom went ahead to Minnesota, and the Butler thing blew up in his face. Okay, listen, it happened. He resisted it in the end. He probably didn't handle it as well as he would have wanted to handle it when he looks back in terms of when he should have traded Jimmy and what he could have gotten for him. But here's a reality. Before Tom got fired there, that team was 15-12 with Dario Saric and Robert Covington and what they got in the Butler deal. So they were playing winning basketball and really were on a track to be competitive for the playoffs. Tom put Minnesota in the playoffs for the first time since Kevin Garnett was there. he goes places and he finds ways to win games. I think a lot of the he plays this guy too many minutes stuff, I think, is way overblown. In the end, he wants to win games. He'll play his best players a lot of minutes. When it comes to young guys that need to develop, guys like Towns and Wiggins, he hammered them into a lot of minutes. To me, New York is a very good situation for him because some of the autocratic style is not going to leave him. It's how Tom does things. And I think that autocratic style with a young New York team is something that that organization desperately needs. Here's the other thing that's really good about the Knicks for Tom Thibodeau with this job. His longtime relationship for Leon Rose being brand new to running an organization, is going to allow Tom some personnel input. Tom is going to be able to do some things there regarding talking about players he wants, guys he wants to bring in, important influences in that locker room. Tom's going to have say. It's not just going to be here's your team and coach it. Tom's going to be very involved on every level of the organization. The fact that he couldn't be in Chicago was very frustrating to him. And in Minnesota, he had all the power. And again, did he make some mistakes in Minnesota? There's no doubt that he did. But I think this kind of role for him in New York, where he's not the guy in terms of personnel, but he has significant input, plus he's the coach with boots on the ground and having a good relationship with the team president, I just think it all adds up to having the right guy on the right job for an organization that, let's face it, has been desperate for almost 20 years to have an adult in the room.
And I have to tell you that in retrospect, with what we're learning about how far behind the Bulls basketball side was, how far behind all their infrastructure of everything, scouting, analytics, how many decades behind that they were, now that Eversley and Karnišević have come in there and looked over and said, what are we dealing with here? It does change the way I look at the relationship in some degree between Thibodeau and the front office, because it has to be difficult. It had to have been difficult for any coach working in that environment.
There's no doubt. Listen, you want to be able to have that open line of communication, Dan, where you can walk in and talk to a GM and talk to a team president, and they understand how your team wants to, how you want your team to play, and you share a vision. That shared vision was totally fractured, and a lot of it had to do with the fact that they weren't thrilled at times with some of the minutes that Tom played guys like Noah and Dang. But Tom was looking at it saying, you hired me to coach to win as many games as possible. We're out here trying to win games. And then when the Rose injuries happened, Tom became a convenient form guy for a lot of that. But all you needed to know is that the first opportunity Derrick Rose got to run back to a Tom Thibodeau coach team in Minnesota, he ran. He wanted to be there. So So Rose didn't necessarily view it that way. So when you look back, yeah, listen, it was that whole thing fractured. And more than that, when you look at how the Bulls handled it, they were so frustrated with that lack of communication with Thibodeau and that lack of vision that they went out and they made a hire that was almost the anti-Thibodeau. Fred Hoiberg, personality-wise, mm-hmm. was the exact opposite of Tom. And it was almost like a knee-jerk reaction for the hire that they made to try to prove that Tom's style didn't work, as opposed to going to get, you know, the right coach for the team. Just somebody clean slate and go from there. And then even I'll take it a step further in getting rid of Fred Hoiberg and going and hiring Jim Boylan. There was also a reflex action in that because of Boylan's level of toughness. You know, Boylan and Thibodeau have a lot more in common than I think Gar and Pax would ever want to admit. So I think for the Bulls here, new management team and a clean slate is something that's going to be enormously important with a hire that has nothing to do with who's coached this team over the course of the last 10 or 15 years, which is something that this past management team that's not there anymore, you know, save for Pax being a consultant, that is they kind of didn't react in the right way to that. And now the clean slate is what the Bulls need so, so desperately.
Brian Geltzeiler, thanks as always. Continued good health to you, my man. Here's to basketball coming back soon.
Looking forward to it, Dan. Same to you and yours, pal. Talk to you soon.
That is Brian Geltzeiler at Hoops Critic, SiriusXM, and HoopsCritic.com. Coming up, we're going to get the latest on the MLB and MLBPA negotiations after that bombshell of a statement from Max Scherzer last night that really put the player's foot down on that and saying, whatever that proposal was, that is a no-go. Here's where we are starting. Here's what we assume to be in evidence. Probably the best Twitter follow on this negotiation and sports labor negotiations in general, Eugene Friedman, at Eugene Friedman on Twitter. He's going to join us next with his take on the score.
People that are listening really need to know that about us as players, is that we really do want to get back and play, and we're doing all we can to get back and play. And that's our number one goal, along with obviously the health that comes with it. But we want to get back and play, and it's important for people to know that.
That's Royals second baseman Whit Merrifield with Cody and Gold from our Kansas City sister station 610 Sports Radio. Of course they want to play. They are baseball players. But they also aren't going to get pushed around by billionaires who are just asking players to give a bunch more money back even after the owners agreed to a 50% pay cut. Now they want to reopen that. It appears the players have pushed that proposal right back across the table. Almost without comment, the commentary came last night via Twitter from Max Scherzer, who wrote, after discussing the latest developments with the rest of the players, there's no need to engage with MLB in any further compensation reductions. We've previously negotiated a pay cut in the version of prorated salaries. There's no justification to accept a second pay cut based upon the current information the union has received. He said, I'm glad to hear other players voicing the same viewpoint. MLB's economic strategy would completely change if all documentation were to become public information. It's a carefully crafted statement there from a member of the MLBPA Executive Subcommittee. Here to give us the details on what's going on is Eugene Friedman. He is on Twitter, at Eugene Friedman. You can follow him there and should throughout all this. And he is a longtime experienced labor lawyer and negotiator and is also an advisor to Baseball Prospectus on such things and is with us now on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline, Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park. Eugene, thanks for joining us again.
Oh, thank you.
What stood out to you in those carefully chosen words from Max Scherzer?
Well, I think, you described it really well in terms of they have already agreed to a pay cut. Now, it's technically not a pay cut if somehow they could get a 162-game schedule in, because what they've agreed to is a prorated salary based on the number of games compared to the normal season. In this case, they also agreed that the commissioner would have the unilateral right, and this is based on reporting from The Athletic. Ken Rosenthal and Evan Drellish reported that they gave the that language that I think we talked about last week on economic feasibility. That gave the commissioner a unilateral ability to determine whether the season will begin at all and when or how many games will be played. So the question here is really the parallel. That agreement in March was something that both parties agreed to. Prorated salaries for the commissioner deciding when and if the season will start. And so the owners came back very publicly. They floated one proposal that they never actually passed across the table and then actually proposed something different early this week saying, oh, we want the top players to take a significant additional pay cut. And Max Scherzer, through his statement, said, we're not entertaining that. We're not even discussing it. It's something that we already agreed to. It's covered by our prior agreement from the end of March. And then apparently the players are taking the position that, well, if you want us to give up something we agreed to in March, we're not going to do that, but we will propose that you give up something you agreed to in March, which is your unilateral discretion on when the season will begin and how long it will be. So we're going to propose that the season actually be 100 games. And so, you know, just along that line, I don't think there's any way management will agree to reopen the March agreement on that question of unilateral authority. It really places management on the defensive the same way the players were on the defensive, saying, look, this was agreed to. We're not reopening it. We have an agreement. We just want to live by that agreement and deal with the other issues. And so I think from that perspective, the union is being very tactical by now showing the owners that they also got something in that March agreement. And unless they're willing to reopen that, there's not going to be any real discussion around that March, those March issues that have been resolved.
If you were going to the owners and also asking for transparency in their revenues and their accounting, we always use the sort of generalized term, open the books. What do you want to see? What documents would be most telling? What actual line items of information do you think you would want to have and maybe you would want the public to know about if you found a way to leak it?
Well, I would say that I don't think that negotiations are best served out in public. I recognize that baseball is a very public industry, but it's always best when the parties negotiate behind closed doors and make progress with each other without the public posturing. That said, I think in this circumstance, in terms of the finances, I think that the players did make a request back probably in the middle of March when some of these discussions first began for financial information from the clubs. And so far, I don't think they've gotten what they're interested in receiving. And there's a lot of, and I'm not an expert on the economies of baseball, so I don't know that I could list everything, but there are a lot of these local television deals, and baseball differs from the NFL very significantly in that the NFL receives the majority of its revenue through the league, through the national TV agreement, and other joint marketing agreements among the different teams. Baseball receives a large percentage of its revenue, or most teams receive the largest percentage of their revenue from local TV contracts. And so that's a key factor, but you also have to consider the fact that a lot of these TV contracts are with companies that are wholly owned by the club or the TV, the media corporation owns the baseball club. So it may not be it's definitely not an arm's length agreement. And so the details of the valuation of that contract are not necessarily as transparent as they should be. So that would be a key factor. And then there's all the non-direct baseball revenue. A lot of the clubs have subsidiary organizations that run parking or concessions at the ballpark. Those things are revenue streams directly related to the operation of baseball, but they're not necessarily on the team's books in terms of what the team is receiving in revenue, but the ownership group is. So all of those things are things that I'd be interested in seeing, and I don't think the owners, individually or collectively, want to share that information.
Well, they haven't for 150 years, and I don't know why they'd start now, because they've been lying about this thing ever since baseball started, and the players were curious about what their role was in their massively successful business from the very beginning. Now, an optimist, well, let's start on the other side. A pessimist would look at where we stand right now and say, oh, forget it. That they've both put their foot down and they've turned their backs to each other and this isn't going anywhere. An optimist would say, you know what? These things are often a bumpy ride, and there's a lot of brinksmanship that goes on, and maybe this is the start of substantive negotiations. This is the feeling out process. This is where they're finding out, they're sort of defining the terms of a negotiation, and now this would be an indication that it's the beginning. And maybe there's going to be other zigs and zags and sort of darkest before the dawn scenarios here, but which is more plausible?
So I would take the optimist tack for a couple of reasons. One, I think it's also a realist tack. I've been in a lot of these negotiations, not obviously with Major League Baseball and the Players Association, but collective bargaining in general. And there are always ups and downs in the process. Normally, those things are not shared publicly. In fact, most of the time, they're not even shared with the union membership, because the negotiating team knows that there are going to be down days and up days throughout the course of negotiation. And they keep those close because they don't want to poison the well. And I think Max Scherzer's statement really talked about that as well, because they did a call or multiple calls, depending on the level of the membership involvement here, whether, you know, the first was with the executive board and perhaps all the player reps, and then perhaps they opened it up to all the members. And it sounds like the players are united because they understand where they are in the process. Their leadership has given them a good picture of where they are and where they expect to be. And that's really important because you don't want to be ahead of your membership on big issues, and you don't want to be behind them either. You want to be strong leaders and share information that's appropriate to be shared so that they can stand with you and support the negotiating team. I think in this particular case, a lot of this posturing is the kind of thing that would happen behind closed doors. But I think both sides are experienced enough to realize that the key to any deal is making a deal on health and safety of players, to make sure that the players themselves feel like they are being taken care of from a health perspective so that they can play on the field without additional worry, that they are not being a vector to transmit the COVID virus to their families. Many of them have young children. Many of them have pregnant wives, including Mike Trout, the face of the game, who seems particularly concerned about leaving his wife during this time. And so, you know, those are all factors that play into this, but those are the real questions that need to be resolved in terms of getting the players back on the field and playing games. Because as the players have said, as the Players Association has said, and Max Scherzer said in his tweet yesterday, they have an agreement on pay. It is for a reduced pay. There's no reason to renegotiate that.
I am very heartened by the public response so far in general that is vastly different from how it used to be. And I mentioned to start the show, and in doing this, being doing a sports radio show for 25 years in one way, shape, or form or another, almost always in a sports labor negotiation, the fans get angry at the players and they call them selfish, entitled divas. You play a kid's game for a living. I do that for a dollar. Everything that people say, how dare they? And it's not happening this time. It's not that people are so much more understanding of labor and of people who are working for a wage, who are very highly compensated because they're great at what they do. And a lot of people want to watch them do it and will pay to watch them do it. We've got a poll up right now. And again, this is unscientific, but the poll up right now at Bernstein670 on Twitter just says, forced to pick a side in baseball's labor negotiations, which side do you choose? With 2,100 votes tallied, 86% of respondents say players. 86% are with the players. And I'm hearing it on other anecdotal ways and unscientific polling. This generation of people now, these 45 and unders, there's not a lot of people siding as easily with billionaires as they used to. Do you think the change in climate is going to affect the owners' approach at all? Do you think the owners get it, or do you think they care?
Well, number one, I don't think they care. I know that they like to be on the side of public opinion, and they use their best efforts to sway public opinion. You know, they have large companies themselves. That's how they, most of them made their money. A lot of them are in media, and they know how to sway the public. But I think in this particular case, there are a lot of people worried about contracting COVID-19. There are a lot of people who are going to work because they're essential employees, and people are really thankful for grocery store clerks, for EMTs and firefighters, for other safety professionals who are required to go to work, for postal workers who are delivering packages in the mail. You know, these people are putting themselves at risk because they are essential. And I think people realize that baseball and other sports are not essential activities to keep people alive and keep them connected, you know, and provide them with the products they need to live. And so that's a really big difference in this. I think, you know, as we roll forward into the next term collective bargaining agreement, there may be a little retreat in that support for the players. But I think in this case, people can identify with them. A lot of people are afraid of going back to work, and they think, you know what? Why should we force baseball players to go back to work just so I can watch them on TV? And I will also say that Chicago is a really strong union town, so that may be affecting your poll as well.
Could be. Yeah, it's a good thought. All good thoughts. And we appreciate your time and all the information. Eugene Friedman, thank you very much for making time for us today.
Thank you for having me.
That is Eugene Friedman, and as this rolls on, I guarantee you we will avail ourselves of his wisdom again, because that guy has been in these kinds of rooms and knows how these things go down. I'm happy to hear that he finds that the optimistic side is also then the realist side. So I guess that's good news. The Midday Midway is coming up. We've got a strange sighting of a rare animal. The actual numbers of it actually surprised me of just how rare indeed the animal is. There's pictures. Evidence to prove it. And also, we're going to play a fun game. All you need to know is your birthday, and I'm going to give you a website and you can plug it in, and we're going to screw around with that a little bit because we were doing that on Twitter yesterday. Figured I would bring it to you next in the Midday Midway on The Score.
The first half or the second half, you know, it's they're two equal times.
Now, Midway.
The Midday Midway.
One, two.
Midway, the most important of the year.
Three, four.
The most exciting thing on the Midway.
Five, six, seven, eight.
Our objective is Midway.
9, 10.
You guys gotta meet me halfway out there.
So real, you can almost feel it.
The Midday Midway with Dan Bernstein on The Score.
We're at the Midday Midway on this show. We had a basketball conversation with Brian Geltzeiler and a baseball labor negotiation conversation with Eugene Friedman. And we also talked about these very different times, and not in the pandemic way of uncertain, unprecedented times, but just how people feel about this labor negotiation and where we are and what has happened with the associations that people of a certain age may have with the elite ruling class and what's happened to their lives, their futures, even before pandemic, what has gone on with the acceleration of inequality and the polarization of haves and have-nots, and how that makes people feel about whether or not they're sympathetic toward billionaires, and just what is happening to inform the way people feel about where their sympathies lie between MLB players and MLB owners. And it was an interesting discussion with a lot of really solid input, and I'm glad we had it. A woman said she saw a wolverine. We feed their fingertips to the wolverines. What was weird, it was on a beach in Washington State. Why would a wolverine be on a beach? They're usually in deep boreal forests. And wildlife officials didn't believe her because she reported it. She told a wildlife official, "I saw a wolverine on the beach. Washington State, Long Beach Peninsula." And they said, yeah, no, you probably didn't. Well, she showed a picture, and guess what? It's a wolverine. The distinctive markings were enough. They talked to WDFW, talked with the WDFW, excuse me, the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. Jeff Lewis is referred to as a mesocarnivore conservation biologist. That is really specific. And he told CNN about the encounter. He himself, mesocarnivore, conservation biologist, confirmed the animal was a wolverine. There are only around 20 of them in the entire state, usually roaming the remote mountainous areas of the North Cascades. And then he compared it to photos that they had on May 20th of a wolverine walking down a road in Nizelle, which is a town east of Long Beach Peninsula, and Lewis has said it is the same animal. There are not two wolverines running around in this particular area. Here's the question. How many wolverines do you think there are total in the contiguous U.S., according to the Center for Biological Diversity? How many? Just take a wild guess. How many actual total Wolverines are there right now? Anyone?
800.
800, says Jay.
I'm going to go with 1,000. 1,000.
300.
My God.
There are only 300 Wolverines. That's it. Oh, my God. That's not enough Wolverines. It's due to trapping and habitat loss. The Wolverine population has been dramatically shrinking. I am watching the documentary, the Earth documentary. I forgot what it was called. The Blue World or whatever. The big one with Attenborough. They had film of a Wolverine that found a caribou or an elk. I forgot which one it was. Frozen. And butchered it. And then hid the various quantities of meat to remain frozen in hiding places. He was like Shane. Or it's like me when the Omaha Steaks box comes. It actually like cut each hind quarter away and like used its adamantium claws or whatever it has to actually butcher the chunks of meat and then hid them in different hiding places that it would remember. The other thing about a Wolverine is apparently they smell horrible. Like, brutally awful, just beyond belief. And that's why they had the nickname Skunk Bear. Because they're not spraying you with anything. They just smell bad.
If the Bears suck again next season, can we call them the Skunk Bears?
Yeah, absolutely. you're entitled. You're Ray. You can do whatever you want. All right, let's play a game here. Because I saw this on Twitter yesterday, and I'm not ashamed to admit it. I saw it in Shane Reardon's Twitter. And I forgot who originated it, and it doesn't matter because it's just one of these things. And all it is, it says, the number one hit song on your 14th birthday, when you can find that song defines your life to this point. Whatever the number one song was on your 14th birthday, mine was in 83. And I don't know if this defines my life. It probably doesn't. And if it does, I'm play it, Ray. Check your fashion and make it happen. Okay. All right, Irene Cara. I hear you. Yeah, that would be Flashdance. What a feeling. I don't know. I don't know if I'm feeling it, but if I'll take it. If that defines my life to this point, I guess I got to count that as a win. Now, I'm yours. What year? 1991, Jay?
Yeah, December 12th, 1991 would be my 14th birthday.
Okay, so what song defines your life to this point?
Black and White. Definitely.
Okay. I mean, maybe if it's describing, I don't know, a black and white cookie?
Look to the cookie.
Look to the cookie, right?
I think this meme is broken. Everyone knows I'm white.
No, man. Maybe you have to confront the fact that you might be black.
I'm fairly positive I'm not. I'm more pink than anything.
Pink or white is not the song, though.
Yeah.
For Michael Jackson, it eventually could have been, as it is for Sammy Sosa.
Yeah.
You know what we have here? Broken meme. Well,
just saying so doesn't make it correct. Meme person.
All right, well, let's see. I don't even want to know the year, Ray Diaz, of your 14th birthday. What year was it?
Mine was 1999.
Oh, good Lord. You can buy a hair that won't grow. You can fix your nose if he says so. You can buy all the makeup the Mac can make. I don't even know what this is.
Take a guess. Girl rap group from the 90s.
TLC?
That's right, Jay. Damn, I'm pretty.
Damn, I'm pretty.
Well, that is correct.
TLC.
I think
okay,
I'm leaving.
The meme is fixed.
The meme is fixed. I think I'm walking away from this one feeling the best out of the three of us.
Well, you do that every day.
Absolutely. Yes.
So that the texters are weighing in here. Now this is awesome. The 630 texter says his baby got back. That's nice.
I'd have to see him to verify.
Yeah. Well,
too bad we can't text photos in for you, Dan.
Yeah, that is good. And believe me, it's good for a lot of reasons. 815 texter says, mine is Part-Time Lover by Stevie Wonder, which is perfect. Oh, that's fun. One more animal story for you. Saber-toothed anchovies. I'll say that again. Saber-toothed anchovies. The fossil record has shown that the anchovies of yore were more formidable than the ones we may encounter now. And by the way, let the record show, anchovies equal awesome. Nothing but awesomeness in every regard, any way you want to serve them, whether you want anchovy paste, whether you want dry packed in salt, whether you want them packed in oil, flat, rolled, on pizza, the Spanish wonderful vinegar-cured white anchovy, everything about them is absolute greatness. That's it.
Hard pass.
Oh, you're a hard pass on all anchovies?
It's one of the things I can't bring myself to taste.
Well, then how do you know you don't like them?
I just know. I can tell. I'll try it. Like, food-wise, I will taste most things and just give it a shot, but I just can't bring myself to try an anchovy. It's just it's too real.
Oh, it's so good. And a little bit of anchovy paste. I mean, it can be a little secret ingredient sometimes in sauces. And
I can imagine how it tastes, and I don't think I like it.
It's very strong. It's very salty, and it's intense. But once you get a taste for it, there's nothing like it. Start with the white anchovies. You'd like those. But an international group of researchers has reported two species of fishes that roamed the seas 40 to 45 million years ago. They had fangs in their lower jaws and a single saber tooth on their upper jaws. They were predators who hunted smaller fishes. And the closest living relative would be what we know as anchovies. So I'm certain that saber-toothed or not, properly prepared, would also be fantastic because they are great. That's one of my rules when traveling overseas. When you're in, anytime you're offered some kind of small, fresh fish, always take it. Always accept the offer, whatever they're doing. If they're like light breading them and frying them, like these little sardines that they have in some of the open markets, if you're wandering along the shoreline as the boats are coming in and you're seeing what the fishermen are coming off and eating, always get it because they're always great and it doesn't matter what they are. It's 100% hit rate when it comes to traveling in other countries. Whatever the popular little small fish preparation is always fantastic. There's your travel tip of the day. Next up, Ian Happ. This is always a whole lot of fun. His roommate, Dakota Mekas, is an absolute certified weirdo. But there's always fun things afoot at the compound. And we're also going to talk about the state of the labor negotiation of baseball and just find out how things are going. Ian Happ comes up next on The Score.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.